pronounced Pildes?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Pildes?
May it please the Court, I will argue the procedural issues concerning the Rule 183 report in this case. The critical issue on this appeal is whether the government can keep secret and refuse to disclose at any time to the taxpayer or to this Court of Appeals the Rule 183 report that contains the findings of fact of the trial judge who presided over this 28-day trial. A Rule 183 report is a document...
This might be an issue in the abstract, certainly, but why is it an issue in this case? Judge Dawson and the special trial judge and the chief judge have all signed off on the proposition that this final opinion followed the previous recommendation of the special trial judge. So why is that an issue here?
Your Honor, the key to the government's theory of how the tax court can operate is at page 110 of their brief. The government's theory is that it is perfectly fine for the trial judge to prepare a Rule 183 report, which they now call an initial report at that page of the brief,
Theory. We may disagree with their theory, but why do they have to rely on that theory on these facts?
Because the government will acknowledge that the report we have in the record is not the Rule 183 report that is required to be prepared, which has legal significance, the findings of fact in which must be treated as binding on the reviewing judge unless the record shows those findings to be clearly erroneous. In other words, the government argues that the practice in the tax court is legal, perfectly fine, in which the Rule 183 report is prepared and filed, as it was in this case. But then the tax court judge and the trial judge can discuss that report, work things out among themselves, come to some understanding about what those findings of fact ought to be on the public record, and that what emerges from this process is the boilerplate document you see in this case, in which the reviewing judge says, I adopt the report, but the report being adopted is not the Rule 183 report. It is a report which has been modified through internal discussions among the reviewing judge and the special trial judge. The result
of
this private process...
Both of them have signed off on the proposition that they haven't reversed any of the findings of fact of the special trial judge. Isn't that correct?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. We don't know what happened. We don't know whether any findings of fact were reversed. We don't know if those findings were reversed, whether they were done pursuant to the clearly erroneous standard that is imported into Rule 183. There is simply no way for this court to know what those initial findings of fact were, what Judge Dawson did with those findings, whether he accepted them or whether he modified them. And I think the government will be frank in acknowledging that this is their understanding of how the process works and that this process is perfectly legal and appropriate. We argued a companion case to this in the 11th Circuit last week. The government acknowledged this as their understanding and description of the tax court practice. Judge Gibson, sitting by designation from the 8th Circuit, described it as a star chamber proceeding. We believe it makes appellate review of the tax court completely impossible for this court.
Well, are you saying that the special trial judge does sign off on the findings of fact that are approved?
Yes, our position is that at the end of the day, once the reviewing judge and the trial judge have worked things out, had whatever discussions, debate, and deliberations take place, and remember, the trial judge serves at the pleasure of the tax court, the trial judge and the reviewing judge reach some agreement, they jointly sign the report that we see in the public record. Since 1984, when this rule went into effect, which made the Rule 183 report secret, there have been over 600 cases we've been able to locate with a special trial judge and a reviewing judge in a situation like this. In not a single case has the reviewing judge on the public record ever modified, let alone reversed, a single finding of fact by the trial judge. Now that means in nearly 20 years and over 600 cases, one of two things has been true. Either the reviewing judge has never seen a finding of fact that ought to be modified in his view, or the process I described is what in fact happens. These agreements or disagreements are worked out internally. They never appear on the public record. They are never reviewable by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals cannot enforce Rule 183. The taxpayer cannot know what findings of fact were made by the trier of fact, who presided for 28 days in a complex trial with 55 witnesses where credibility was a critical issue. I think this completely bypasses the entire appellate review process.
Well, this procedure seems to me to be very unusual, which I've addressed some questions to the government about. But is it unconstitutional? Isn't that the issue before us?
Well, my first view about this is it clearly violates this court's appellate review jurisdiction. The appellate review statute requires this court to review the tax court decisions and reverse them if they are not in accordance with law. Now, a violation of Rule 183, which the D.C. Circuit says, as a matter of law, imposes a clearly erroneous standard on the reviewing judge of the tax court, that's a legal rule which this court must enforce. So it violates, first, this court's review powers under the statute for the tax court review process. Secondly,
well,
I believe...
Well, if you're an administrative agency and the administrative law judge made a finding which is reversed by the agency... they don't necessarily apply a clearly erroneous rule in those circumstances.
That's correct, Your Honor. But first of all, in an administrative agency context, the report of the ALJ is part of the record.
Well, I know that.
And the appellate court applies.
Pursue the government about.
Right. The appellate court applied the substantial evidence standard to that entire record.
Yeah, that's the general practice.
And secondly, Your Honor, the tax court is clearly not an administrative agency. It was not set up by Congress when Congress created it as an Article I court, as anything other than a court. The Supreme Court in
Freitag... Well, I know, but this is seems to me, in this kind of circumstance, a distinction without a difference, isn't it?
Oh, Your Honor, I think it makes...
You call it a court or you call it an agency. What difference does it make?
Well, I agree that one can't be overly formalistic about labels. That's correct. But when one looks at the process of adjudication set up by the statutes, the Supreme Court's understanding in Freitag that the tax court does nothing but exercise judicial power, the D.C. Circuit's decision in Stone that because of the judicial nature of tax court proceedings, the clearly erroneous standard binds the reviewing judge who has not heard the witnesses. And remember, this is a tax fraud case, where there are serious due process issues about credibility judgments, which are critical to this case. I think in light of all of those considerations, the fact that the tax court is set up by Congress, treated by the Supreme Court, treated by the D.C. Circuit, in fact, treated by this court, an opinion by Judge Posner in the United Airlines case, as a judicial body that functions very much like the district courts, I think that has a great deal of significance.
And can you make a comparison between a district court's review of Chapter 11 bankruptcy report and recommendation, not an appeal, but a report and recommendation from the bankruptcy judge?
We actually don't discuss the bankruptcy process in the briefs, Your Honor.
I'm asking you to do that now.
Well, I confess I'm not a very expert on the bankruptcy process.
Right.
But
I'll
when
ask
it comes,
I'll ask the government the same question about whether or not the district judge has the power to change what would have been findings of fact and a report and recommendation.
Your Honor, we do know that in the case of masters appointed by district judges, the district judge can only overturn those findings if clearly erroneous. We know in a number of magistrate contexts, same standard applies. This is a proceeding that's extremely adjudicative, judicial, very high individual stakes. Not
or,
just the money.
Bankruptcy. That's why I was using it.
Well, but it's the fraud issue in addition to simply the deficiency. Civil tax fraud is an extremely serious reputational injury, as I'm sure you're aware. And in fact, in this case, the taxpayer suffered a number of secondary consequences as a result of this ultimate opinion finding fraud, where we believe the actual trier of fact found no fraud, in part because he found many of the witnesses, including the taxpayer, credible. And I do not see how we can have a legal adjudicative process where the crucial findings of fact, which have legal significance and must be deferred to, can be kept secret by the government, not disclosed at any time to this court, to the taxpayer, to the public, which oversees the process, like academics. We aren't even arguing that that report must be disclosed at the moment it's filed. We take no position on that. We asked for that report three different times after the decision of the tax court came out. We asked for it to be filed under seal with this court, and the government refused to do that. The government's position is that this is somehow protected by deliberative privilege, and I cannot understand how that can possibly be the case with a legally significant document that has findings of fact, that have legal meaning, that must be deferred to by the reviewing judge, and that this court, when it reviews the decision, if there's a disagreement internally, has to look to decide how to resolve that disagreement. I mean, I think what's going on here is that when the tax court amended that rule in 1984 to deny access to this report, they effectively created a system in which the tax court judges can send long, complicated cases off to the trial judges, maintain full control of decision-making with no public or judicial accountability. You cannot review the role the tax court judge has played in this case with respect to the findings of fact made by the trier of fact who presided over that trial. They have simply made it impossible by the way they are working out this practice in the tax court. I've never seen anything like it in any administrative agency, let alone in any judicial tribunal, whether an Article I or an Article III tribunal. No court operates this way. In fact, no agency operates this way. And in light of the history of the change in this rule, which shut the doors to access to this report, it seems plausible to infer that the tax court was trying to accomplish exactly what it accomplished here. That is, before the rule changed, the public record reflected any disagreement between the tax court judge and the trial judge. That disagreement was obvious in the Stone case, and the rule was changed during the litigation in Stone. And in fact, ultimately, the tax court judge was vulnerable because the Court of Appeals reversed his finding based on the view that he had not respected the clearly erroneous standard. Now, they have ensured that that vulnerability will never recur. They have made it impossible for the situation to arise in which you will see that disagreement played out on the public record. That simply cannot comply with the statutes that regulate the tax court. It cannot comply with the Article III review powers of this court over the tax court. And it certainly can't comply with fundamental notions of fairness and due process. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dick.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Randall Dick, and I represent the estate of Burton W. Cantor. As you all know, there are many tax issues raised in this appeal. However, today I only want to touch on three of them. The rest, I hope, are adequately addressed on brief. First, I would like to briefly discuss the tax court's fraud finding, which we believe is simply not supported by the evidence. Second, I would like to address the tax court's failure to shift the burden of proof to the government on the issue of whether income of the B. Rich Trust could be attributed to Mr. Cantor. And lastly, I wish to address the bank deposit issue and why not only should the government have borne the burden of proof, but also why the amount at issue was significantly less than the tax court found. Let me first stress what this case is not about. This case is not about unreported income. All of the income at issue was in fact reported by the entities involved. What this case is really about is whether it was fraudulent for Mr. Cantor to utilize a well-known estate planning technique to reduce his estate. That is, by having family-owned entities make investments which he could have made himself. Having family-owned entities make investments, which one thinks will appreciate, allows one to remove any future appreciation in that investment from his estate and thus to reduce any future estate tax. Thus, it is easy to understand why Judge Kuvion determined in his original report that the utilization of these estate planning techniques was not income tax fraud.
You've conceded, though, I gather, that in this case, this income should be attributed to him, have you not?
For purposes of the appeal, we did.
So the only thing we're dealing with here is fraud.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it significant, though, that you, in five different instances, misreported this income?
We submit that it wasn't misreported, Your Honor.
Well, you conceded it's
not
it was correct. You conceded the service is right for purposes of this appeal, haven't you?
For purposes of this appeal, we did not appeal that issue, we believe that the fraud issue is much more economically and reputationally damaging to the taxpayer.
No, but one of the indicia of fraud is that if you've done it repeatedly, and you have done it repeatedly, haven't you?
I don't think failure to appeal an issue is an admission that what the tax court reported had happened was, in fact, what happened. And I think also if you grant the Rule 183 report, if you get to look at that, you will find that the original judge found there was no fraud. And we do submit this case is simply a case about a
you
state.
You say that the special trial judge found that there was no fraud?
Yes, sir.
Now, what's your basis for that conclusion?
I think my declaration is in the record, Your Honor. I had two judges tell me that.
Who are the two judges?
I'm not sure that's particularly relevant, but...
Well, I think it's relevant. I asked you a question.
Okay.
I expect an answer.
It was Judge Jacobs, Julian Jacobs, and Chief Special Trial Judge Panuthas.
Okay. What's the nature of that communication? How does that surface, a communication with one of the judges with a counsel to the party?
How did it surface?
Well, how did it occur? What's the setting?
Was
the government in attendance at that meeting?
No, one was over lunch, and position of that was relayed to me was that this is just the procedure the tax court uses. There's no...
I'm not talking about a discussion about procedure. I want to know if we have an instance here of ongoing litigation and contact between judges and attorneys for one side without the other party being in attendance. That's all I'm asking.
Well, there were no other people in attendance.
Is this somehow normal practice in the tax field?
The tax court, I would say, is very informal in that regard, Your Honor.
You had lunch with the judges deciding the case?
No. No, that you don't do, Your Honor.
Well, what stage of the litigation when you had this contact?
Just after the opinions were all issued.
And
was it final?
The opinion had been issued, but the computations had not been filed. And in tax court context, the decision becomes final once the parties or the court finally tell you what the number is.
These are other judges of the tax courts that didn't participate in this.
That's correct,
decision.
Your Honor.
But they knew of the internal operations in this case, or discussions in this case.
Yes. They also knew about the general practice of how tax special trial judges' reports have been handled since the rule change, which is pretty much as Mr. Pildes just reflected to you.
Well, my concern is not about as much about, at least, you're seeking information about the procedures, although I don't know that that couldn't have been found in a different forum. My concern is, you raise the question. I mean, it is your assertion that this occurred because of the representation of these specific judges, Mr. Deck, right?
What occurred, Your Honor?
Of the disagreement that you say that existed in this case that's unreported.
The fact that originally there was no fraud.
Right, yeah. That comes into this record because you have established that through your affidavit, mm-hmm. Reflecting your contact with the judge, your investigation, let's call it.
Yeah, which is, by the way, has never been argued against by either the court or the government.
Well, that's some surprise to me, too. But perhaps I'm just not as familiar with these unique practices.
No, I think, Judge, I think the tax court believes that what occurred is perfectly proper in the context of a special trial.
Well, we'll ask the government if that's the context. I don't want to take time away from your argument.
Okay. I'd like to now move to the Beveridge Trust issue. In this issue, it is clear that the government changed its position on this at trial. The tax court allowed the government to change its theory from an allegation that Mr. Cantor should have included income earned by the trust in 1987 to an allegation that Mr. Cantor had additional income in 1986. It is also clear that the burden of proof should have shifted to the government under tax court rule 142A, which clearly provides that the burden of proof shifts when a new matter is raised. The government amended generated a new and increased sufficiency in a different year, and it required the introduction of different evidence. Thus, as a matter of law, we submit it was a new matter shifting the burden of proof. And we submit the government did not introduce anywhere near sufficient evidence to carry this burden. Moreover, even without considering the burden issue, it is not at all clear on what basis the tax court determined that the trusts were grantor trusts. First, the court said that Mr. Cantor was the grantor because he failed to prove that he was not the grantor. When it was pointed out that the government had stipulated that B. Rich was the grantor, the court then stated that Mr. Cantor had a power of appointment based on the establishment of certain other trusts, the JSK trust. When Mr. Cantor pointed out to the court that he had not created the JSK trust, the court held in its August 14, 2000 order that, quote, our whole thing is based on facts and circumstances establishing that in substance for the years at issue and with respect to the transaction in question, that Cantor in fact was the grantor of the B. Rich Trust, end quote. I am not sure what this statement means, but I am sure that the opinion does not set forth one single fact or discuss one single incident which occurred during 1986 or 87 which would support the court's holding. Thus, we are at a real loss to discern the basis for the decision, and case law makes it clear that when this occurs, the case should be remanded. You know, I'd like to reserve any additional time I may have for rebuttal. I know I didn't get to the last issue, but...
Well, you have some time. You had not initially indicated reserving any time, but...
Right,
but I know Mr. Pilgers did, but okay. If you want to reserve, I'll certainly honor that.
Maybe if I can go quickly for...
Sure.
The last issue is the bank deposit issue. And let me set the stage a bit for this, which is that 6 days before the notice of the sufficiency was issued, which is the determination of the government, which allows you to appeal either to the district court or to the tax court, the IRS determined that Mr. Cantor had $2.8 million in unreported income. This was a result of receiving information from American National Bank with a summons, and as I said, this was 6 days before the notice was issued. Mr. Cantor's bank statements had not theretofore been requested by the government. The government thereafter alleged that Mr. Cantor failed to maintain adequate books and records and calculated his Schedule C income by simply adding up all the deposits to Mr. Cantor's account. At trial, however, Mr. Cantor produced his original books and records, which consisted of his checkbooks and deposit slips, which had heretofore been maintained by certified public accountants and which were admitted into evidence without objection. Ms. Gallenberger, also a CPA, summarized these records and discussed her summaries with the revenue agent of the Internal Revenue Service. Thereafter, the government conceded a majority of the adjustments, which totaled approximately $1.5 million. In addition, at that time, the government changed its theory by alleging that only certain loans, which were identified in Ms. Gallenberger's summaries, were income. We submit that the government changed its theory of the case from alleging that Mr. Cantor maintained insufficient records to alleging that only certain loans were income, and the burden of proving that loan constituted income shifted to the government because the government raised a new matter requiring the introduction of different evidence. Thus, if the government did not produce any evidence in this case, the tax court's decision should be reversed. But in any event, after subtracting the payments that were made on the loans at issue, also in 1982, the same year as the loans were made, the total amount in issue is not 2.8, it's not 1.4, it is $219,000.
Mr. Deck, your time had expired, but were you going to touch on the sale of the painting, or is that Ms. Hawkins?
No, I think that
just issue rest
is
on the brief.
But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No, that's all right. I'll the brief. If you want to rest on the brief, that's fine.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hawkins?
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to just make a few points on behalf of Naomi Cantor's portion of this appeal. The positions taken by the tax court and by the United States regarding the 6015 G2 issue raises a legal question for this court to review de novo. The question is, when is the appropriate time to raise and decide whether a taxpayer has meaningfully participated in a tax trial? by stating in its order that a factual finding that Naomi Cantor had not meaningfully participated in the tax trial would be premature and advisory, the tax court has essentially read the statute to preclude a trial judge from ever making a G2 determination, when the trial judge is exactly the right person to be making a determination as to whether a party has meaningfully participated.
Well, I guess the government is saying you got to wait till the collection procedure to raise this issue, right?
Well, I think the tax court also says that you have to wait until the collection proceeding. But I think that they both read the statute incorrectly and they misread the legislative history. If you look at the original statute when it was enacted in 1998, the race judicata language was part of E3, which was the portion of the statute which gives jurisdiction to the tax court and devises the rules for petitioning the tax court.
Well, race judicata is ordinarily a defense, isn't it? And the concept is that she can raise this defense when the government comes after her for the money, isn't it?
You've hit the argument, I think, precisely on the head, Your Honor. There was a debate when 6015 was first enacted as to whether any of these relief provisions could be raised prior to the commencement of collection activity. And the debate was ultimately resolved in two ways. One, the tax court started to see the wisdom of allowing affirmative defenses that raised the elections under B, C, and F. And then ultimately, in 2000, Congress amended the statute so that it took the race judicata issue out of E3 and created a separate subsection for it, as well as making a clear statement that it was not Congress's intention in enacting 6015 to deny what had otherwise been appropriate defenses for a taxpayer at the petition level. So it would be our position that G2 as a provision is to be considered at the time of an administrative election under Section 6015, but that in no means precludes the taxpayer, or for that matter the government, for asking for a ruling during the actual trial when all of the activities and events are in full view of the trial judge for a statement about whether there has been meaningful participation. Reading the G2 language as the tax court seems to require a second standalone proceeding to determine whether Naomi Cantor has meaningfully participated in the concluded litigation, I think is a misreading of the language of the statute, and it's contrary to Congress's clear express intent in enacting a remedial statute.
Ms. Hawkins, do we have any case we can look to with any factual similarity to Ms. Cantor's?
If you're talking about G2, I've seen nothing at all. The legislative history is bare. I think we have to look to the legislative history of the entire statute, and particularly some of the statements from Congress when it amended the statute in 2000, making it clear that it wanted all of the issues under 6015 to be resolved, preferably in a single administrative or judicial proceeding at the earliest possible moment when it could be raised. There are at least two other points I would like to make. One is, both of them are related to the court's abuse of discretion under what I consider to be extraordinary circumstances in denying the reopening of the record to hear Mrs. Cantor's evidence on her entitlement to relief under the subsections of 6015. The first is the conflict of interest which her earlier lawyers had from the inception of this litigation. The tax court finesses that conflict issue by concluding, without hearing any evidence, that Naomi Cantor failed to recognize the conflict, failed to obtain separate counsel, and failed to raise 6015 at an earlier point in the litigation. Keep in mind the trial concluded 4 years before the statute was enacted. Both the DeVore and the Wilson cases, I think, tell us that when a conflict of interest is determined, at a very minimum, an evidentiary hearing should be held to determine whether the conflict of counsel in fact prejudiced the taxpayer, and whether it was reasonable or unreasonable for that taxpayer not to have obtained separate counsel. If Naomi Cantor satisfies both of these inquiries, DeVore and Wilson say she's entitled to a new trial on her 6015 defenses. The conflict of Naomi Cantor's earlier counsel go directly to the issue of whether she could have meaningfully participated in this litigation. The second point I'll make quickly is the parties effectively stipulated to the fact that she had not meaningfully participated by the government's concession to the first portion of the motion. And despite this, and I think without foundation, the tax court rejected even that.
Thank you, Ms. Austin.
Mr. Parks?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I've been asked to speak to the due process issue only, and my colleague, Joan Oppenheimer, who has studied the record, will speak to the merits. The opinion of the tax court and the August 30th order of the tax court, which is signed by the special trial judge, regular judge, and chief judge, both say that the opinion that's entered that is before this court is the opinion of the special trial judge. And the contention, the due process contentions of the taxpayers are based primarily on the affidavit, which says the counsel was told by two judges of the tax court that the special trial judge had taken a different view in his original report. We know, though, what the special trial judge's view of the case was at the time the opinion was entered. The record shows that. That's what the opinion and the August 30th order say.
Are you willing to furnish us with a copy of the special trial judge's report under seal?
Well, Your Honor, the tax court regards that as part of its deliberative process.
Well, I asked you a question. It's easy to answer. You're going to say yes or no, right?
In this proceeding, we're not representing the tax court, we're representing the commissioner. The commissioner has no more access to it than the taxpayer.
Well, you're saying a reviewing court doesn't have any access to a document, which I gather is formally submitted from the taker of the record, whatever you call him, the special trial judge.
Right.
To another judge.
That's right.
You're saying that's secret. We can't see it.
I'm saying it's part of the internal deliberative process of the tax court.
You know, what strikes me here, I don't know what the Constitution provides here, but as far as I know, it's a universal practice in administrative law. If this were governed by the Administrative Procedure Act, the person taking the record would have to make up a recommended decision and make it public, and that would then be subject to review by the agency, right? Isn't that
under the
things
administrative
work?
Procedure? Hmm? Well, I let me give you the flip side.
I mean, why is the tax court different from everybody else that's in this business?
Well,
that's
for two
what
reasons.
I'd like to know.
For two reasons. One is Section 7460. It was enacted in 1928. It governs the relationship between regular judges when a case is reviewed by the full court. And it provides specifically that when a regular judge, the one who was there at trial hearing the testimony, when that report is reviewed by the full court, the report of the hearing judge, and I use that term in quotation marks, is by statute excluded from the record. It must be excluded from the record. The procedure here is really essentially the same. You're talking about special trial judge, regular judge, rather than regular judge, full court.
Well, I gather that before, 1984, you made this document public. Didn't you?
The tax court did, but it changed its rules, of course. And the Fifth Circuit, let me just briefly say Morgan, because in Morgan, no report was prepared in Morgan.
Morgan just involved the issue of whether the official that takes the record has to make the decision. That's a different question.
Hearing doesn't mean having personally heard the witnesses. You can use an examiner who may not prepare a report.
Yeah, well, I think that's done all the time, but it's very unusual, in my opinion, to say that you have one judge making a report. The judge who conducts the hearing or the trial makes a report to some other judge, which is a secret document, and both of them then get together to decide what happened. This is very unusual. You will concede that this is not the case with administrative agencies, and your brief, of course, says it's not comparable to magistrates, so I don't know what it is comparable to.
Well, it's comparable to Section 7460, which has governed tax court proceedings for 70 years. And the report of the hearing, and I don't want to say hearing judge because hearing has connotations, the report of the judge who was physically present at trial is by statute excluded from the record. And that's the same thing here. That's the
well, now you say it was provided, though, before 1984.
Yeah.
Does that violate the statute or what? I mean, how do
well,
you...
Well, two things. First is the Fifth Circuit in Freytag noted that that change shows that there's not an appellate sort of trial relationship between special trial judges and regular judges. But the second thing is, the point you're getting to is exactly the point we were going to make. The statute doesn't allow the chief judge to assign a case to a special trial judge to allow the special trial judge to decide the case, with a few minor exceptions. So if you had a situation where a regular judge, by virtue of some standard of review, whatever that is, has to defer to the view of the special trial judge, and the special trial judge's view then governs, then the special trial judge, by definition, would have decided the case, because the regular judge's view is not the view that would prevail.
What's the function of the special trial judge?
Largely to take evidence for the benefit of the judge ultimately assigned responsibility for deciding the case.
Because of volume, that the tax court couldn't conduct it themselves?
It's probably more a matter of history. Shortly after around in the early 1940s, the Congress gave the tax court authority to begin using what were then commissioners, and over the years that practice has grown and expanded. And I certainly, if you didn't have special trial judges, you would need a lot more.
I thought you said the statute went back to 1928.
Well, the Board of Tax Appeals came into existence in 42, became the tax court, and 69 became an Article I court.
Similar to the progression of the bankruptcy court. I'll ask you the question about the analogy with bankruptcy.
The difficulty I have with that, Your Honor, is that Northern Pipeline says that bankruptcy matters are types of matters that must go to Article III courts. Tax matters are so-called public rights cases, which can be assigned for adjudication to administrative agencies. And so you may very well have, there are at the very least some nuances that would need to be considered in that context.
I'm referring to 28 U.S.C. Section 157 C1, which governs referral non-court proceedings in Chapter 11.
In non-court proceedings. I have to confess that I don't have...
It just said, in such proceedings, the bankruptcy judge shall submit proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law, to the district court, and any final order or judgment shall be entered by the district judge after considering the bankruptcy judge's proposed findings and conclusions, after reviewing de novo those matters to which any party has timely and specifically objected, which includes a public disclosure of the bankruptcy judge's report. It's similar to the magistrates.
I wouldn't say that's similar to magistrates, because magistrates generally make findings, and they're not recommendations, and there is a formal standard of review applicable to the review of those findings.
Proposed recommendations and findings made by magistrates.
The Supreme Court in Colorado versus New Mexico uses special masters, and it says that when it reviews it, it gives...
Special masters are not magistrates, unless they're made special. Magistrates are made special masters, which they can be.
You have a statute for magistrates, and the tax court has a statute for...
And a statute for bankruptcy judges. I'm trying to get an analogous circumstances, which I think that's what we're all looking at, is what is standard judicial procedure in these types of things.
Well, in agency adjudication, first of all, if you're looking at the standard for agency adjudication, Morgan says the one who hears has to decide, but hearing doesn't mean having personally heard the witnesses. You can use examiners, and the examiner may not prepare a report.
Well, is there anything we can look to where someone who hears the evidence creates a report that is unreviewable?
The closest would be what is mandated by Congress and has been for 70 years, Section 7460.
So it's a sort of a standalone situation we have here.
Well, it's been the practice more
You're
than
saying that there's no analogies in adjudication, either administrative or judicial.
In terms of providing the
you can't give us any analogy, right?
Well, 7460 Morgan, because in a Morgan the...
Have you ever heard of the universal camera case, which was went to the Supreme Court and involved it where the ALJ, it was a labor board, where the labor board reversed the ALJ in a matter and went to the Supreme Court. Have you ever... That is the same kind of situation we have here.
Well, what was the outcome? I
can't remember what the outcome was. If you would recall the case, I'd ask you that question. But
you do have here a procedure that Congress has mandated on regular judges for 70 years.
Is there any documentation or policy statement that speaks to the reason for the change in 84?
The rule does not explain the reason for the change, but when you withdraw the procedure whereby you're giving parties copies of reports, then by definition you're no longer in a magistrate sort of situation, and the change in rules itself is one which really just goes.
Was there any literature that about the change?
None of which I'm aware. None of which I'm aware. Well, I see my time has expired unless the court has questions.
No, I guess not.
Thank you,
Mr. Parks. Ms. Oppenheimer?
The evidence of tax fraud in this case is not only clear and convincing, it is overwhelming. For purposes of this appeal, Cantor has conceded unreported income totaling $3.4 million between 1979 and 1989. Unreported, the consistent and substantial understatement of income is itself evidence of fraudulent intent. Furthermore, Cantor was the mastermind of a complex money laundering scheme to conceal and distribute this income. He was the one that was in charge of the creation of Carlco, TMT, and BWK, which ultimately became subsidiaries of IRA, and to whom the proceeds of the transactions with the five were distributed in a 45-45-10 split. It was his doing that the proceeds from this scheme to assist friends of his obtaining business opportunities from Prudential. It was his doing that the kickbacks that were supplied to the three were paid to IRA and Zeus and the holding company instead of the three directly. In addition to his complex money laundering scheme, he also used BWK as his nominee to distribute the unreported to receive the unreported income for himself. He was responsible for the commingling of the income, of his income and that of Lyle and Ballard in these entities. He directed the destruction of documents after they were summoned. He directed his agent Gallenberger not to produce other summoned documents that were in existence. His testimony was dishonest at trial. The evidence is overwhelming in support of his fraudulent intent. As far as the B. Rich Trust is concerned, we submit that the evidence supports the determination of the court regardless of where the burden of proof lies. But we also submit that there was in reality a split burden of proof. The government at trial did amend its pleadings to change the year in which the deficiency resulting from BRT underreporting, it switched the year from 87 to 86. We submit that it then bore the burden of proving that there was income for that year, which it proved by submitting the K-1s, and we submit that Cantor retained the burden of proving that BRT was not his grantor trust. This issue was raised in the notice of deficiency. It was the same issue for 87 to 86. We submit that he retained the burden, but regardless of who retained the burden, the court did not clearly err in finding that BRT was
part of the allegation of fraud here was based upon his borrowing money from the trust, right?
As far as the grantor trust issue is concerned, yes.
Yeah. And there's evidence apparently as to the year 87 where how much he borrowed and how much he paid back in that year. Is there any evidence about 86 on the same point?
Well, I think um,
she borrowed money before BRT, before 1987, and he owed it $287,000 as of the 1st of 1987. Presumably, he didn't borrow the money on January 1st. He borrowed it in 1986 or before, and he owed it $287,000 on 1987. We submit that that's adequate evidence to show that it was his grantor trust under Section 675, subsection 3, but an alternate ground for holding that he was liable under the grantor trust provisions is Section 674, which makes him liable as a grantor if he, to the extent he is a non-adverse party, that he has the power of disposition over the trust assets, or a non-adverse party had a power of disposition over the trust assets. And we submit first that he had a power of disposition over the trust assets, and alternatively that the trustee, who was a non-adverse party, had a power of disposition over the trust assets. He had a power of disposition over the trust assets by virtue of the power of disposition contained in the trust instrument himself. He had the power to appoint any of the assets over which he was a beneficiary. Although he claimed he renounced this interest, the court found that this renunciation was a sham and that he in fact exercised this power of appointment by creating 60 JSK trusts that were the beneficiaries of BRT Trust. Now, he claims that he moved for reconsideration on this issue in which it was alleged that his children were the grantors of the JSK Trust and that this motion was improperly denied. The standard of review for a motion for reconsideration is abuse of discretion. We submit the court did not abuse its discretion. Indeed, the allegations in the motion for reconsideration do not even come within the terms of the statute, because even if the children were the grantors of the JSK Trust, it's not alleged that they had the power to appoint BRT's assets to these trusts, or that they did appoint the assets to these trusts. So we submit that that he was liable under Section 674, and furthermore, Weisskopf, who was the trustee, had the power to appoint the trust at either the income or the beneficiary, either the income or the corpus, to any of the beneficiaries of the trust. Weisskopf was not an adverse party or an independent trustee. He was subject at all times to the control of Cantor. We submit also that Cantor was the, in effect, the grantor of the B. Rich Trust because he funded it. He was responsible for funding BRT stock interest by transferring his personal services income from the five to IRA and also to the holding company, which were owned by, in substantial part, by B. Rich Trust. He also funded B. Rich Trust by in effect, transferring his income from the Cablevision venture to BR Trust. He was an investor, and I'd like to, he basically solicited investors for Cablevision in return for the solicitation of investors. The Cantor and his partners were given interest in the Cablevision venture. These interests were then transferred to B. Rich Trust. And these interests were, in fact, the interests that resulted in the capital gain in 1986. Now, the taxpayer relies on Stotlin versus Levenfeld, a case by the Illinois court, to say that the tax court's findings were inconsistent with that case. That is simply not true. The only issue presented by the court in that case was whether the interests in these partnerships were legal fees for services rendered. The court held they were not. In fact, the plaintiff in that case, a former partner of Cantor's, moved to amend the pleadings in that case to allege that if the amounts were not fees, they were investments which the partners were required under the partnership agreement to offer him. The court denied the motion to amend, thus making it quite clear that they didn't decide the issue before this court. As far as the bank deposits issue is concerned, the burden of proof never shifted to the government. What the government did at trial is it reduced the initial deficiency claimed in that issue from $2 million to about $1.3 million as a result of certain disclosures by Cantor and his agents. It reduced the deficiency. This was a concession. It was not an amendment. It had no effect on the burden of proof, which remained on Cantor. We submit that Cantor did not satisfy his burden, that basically what was submitted was exhibits prepared by Gallenberger, his accountant. Gallenberger was somebody who had no independent authority. She testified that she did not have decision-making authority, that she was in all respects. She took directions from Cantor. The records that she prepared in support of Cantor's position were Cantor's records. The court found Cantor to be unreliable in the highest degree. Gallenberger was also unreliable. She destroyed summoned records after the summonses were issued. She destroyed them at Cantor's request. She also failed to produce summoned records after an order of enforcement and until she was threatened with contempt proceedings. Her testimony and her exhibits are totally unreliable. She was the president of Administrative Services, which was the record-keeping entity, with respect to the loans, the reputed loans in issue, but yet she failed to examine the records. She failed to do anything but look at Cantor's self-serving records. Finally, with respect to the Section 6015G issue, we submit that the court was without jurisdiction to decide the issue that was addressed by, that was raised by Naomi. Section 6015G2, the language is clear on its face. It says, in case of any election under subsection B or C, if a decision of a court in any prior proceeding has become final, such decision shall be conclusive except with respect to the qualification for relief which was not at issue in such proceeding. And then it says the exception does not apply if the court determines that the individual participated meaningfully in such prior proceeding. We submit that the use of the word prior proceeding makes it clear that the determination is to be made in the second proceeding and not in the proceeding at issue. If the court has no further questions.
I'd like to ask you a question about the equitable leasing payments.
Okay.
There's one of them for $302,000. This was, I guess, decided in part at least because some of these payments were marked commissions or COM,
right.
Period. There's one for $302,000 that had no such notation, and I gather Cantor claims it was a repayment of a loan, and I get the impression that they're saying that was indicated by something in the records. Can you tell me what the basis of the decision on that payment was?
I think the court, one of the reasons the court found that all those payments were services for money was partly based based on the testimony of Malin, that he did pay commissions for the obtaining of computer leaseback payments, on the fact that Cantor failed to satisfy his burden of proof, and on the fact that Cantor had a practice of allocating, Cantor had the practice of putting money that he earned in corporations he controlled. So
I gather that, but I hear that all the other payments are, I gather, the main basis of decision is that they were marked commission or abbreviation for commission, but this one wasn't marked. I was just wondering whether it was going to throw in with the other ones, even though it was not specifically marked.
I think it goes primarily on the burden of proof, which Cantor had and which he failed to satisfy, and also on Malin's testimony that he did, pay commissions in return for obtaining investors for his computer sale leaseback transactions.
Do you have any comment on Mr. Dick's affidavit with regard to contacting tax court judges? Does the commissioner have any interest in that?
That is an issue that Mr. Parks has responsibility for.
All right. You have a little time left. I'll ask Mr. Parks. Mr. Parks, you have any comment on that? Does the commissioner have any position on Mr. Dick's affidavit regarding contact with the tax court?
First, that maybe I didn't quite understand the question. Are you getting to the merits or the
No, just
practice.
The practice. That's all. The discussion I had with Mr. Dick about contacting tax court judges.
Oh, that is not my province.
Not your province. I'm Ms. Oppenheimer's province. Do we have a third attorney here representing the commissioner that I can speak to about that?
I'm not sure quite what you're.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to be helpful.
I'm sure you are. I'm sure.
Well, do you just personally consider it a normal practice that occurs in tax court proceedings, where there's conversation while a case is still pending between tax court or special tax court judges or tax court judges and counsel of ex parte?
Judges who are not assigned to the specific case. I just don't know.
Have you ever heard of that?
I'm not sure that if it occurred or not, I would know. I don't work in the same building.
Just a minute. Go ahead. That's up to Chief Judge Flom, is what he wants.
I don't want to create a record that's not before us. I've just wanted some indication of the nature of the practice. I'm not suggesting anything other than some inquiry about it.
Perhaps I could, by way of clarification, in the Department of Justice, where we work, we only handle cases in the courts of appeal, so we don't practice in the tax court. So it's not something of which we.
All right, that's fine, and. If we don't have an attorney of record that's able to aid us in that, then we just do not have that. And I am not going to solicit the views of attorneys in attendance on the matter. I appreciate your candor and your statements in that regard, Mr. Parks. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Oppenheimer. Ms. Fildes.
Judge Cummings, you asked for analogies to the situation. Section 557 of the APA does specifically say all decisions, including initial, recommended, and tentative decisions, are part of the record. Secondly, I would
ask you the same questions I'd ask the government. Is there any literature that you've uncovered that spoke to the policy change in 83, 84?
Yes, Your Honor. There's an article in Tax Notes, which is at Appendix 14 or Addendum 14 to our brief by Mr. Kafka, which is extremely critical of the tax court practice. This has been an issue debated in tax notes among tax
practitioners. What is your view of the statute in the 20s that the government says shields this document?
I find that a baffling position, frankly, Your Honor. As you indicated, the document was routinely disclosed for many, many years. This kind of document is routinely disclosed by all administrative agencies and judicial bodies. It's inconceivable to me that Congress could have enacted a statute which closed off access to the findings of fact in a lengthy, complex trial like this. I also would ask Your Honors to take a look at the order Judge Dawson entered in response to our initial motion at Joint Appendix 257. This case could have gone away with respect to the procedural issue if Judge Dawson had simply responded to our motion by saying the Rule 183 report, which is required to be filed, is the document in the record. And that's not what Judge Dawson says. He gives lengthy reasons. It's protected by deliberative privilege. We didn't consent to a trial before a special trial judge. I don't really understand the bearing of our non-consent to our non-access to the report. And he refers to the report of the trial judge that was ultimately adopted by Judge Dawson. So there's nothing which specifically answers the very direct question posed in our motion, which could have made this issue go away. And I submit there's no answer to that because the practice is, as I think both sides have acknowledged.
The problem is that a judge who did not hear the evidence may have participated in the final conclusions of findings of fact.
Without respecting the legally mandated, clearly erroneous standard. In fact, Your Honor, I think we've made the case a little bit more complex than it needs to be because we don't need to look outside the tax court rules. The due process considerations are in the background. But the rule itself, as interpreted by the D.C. Circuit in a detailed opinion 13 years ago in Stone, imposes this clearly erroneous standard on the reviewing judge. Now, you have to be able to determine whether that rule has been followed or not.
But the problem is that they were at least close in time before the rule changed when it said the findings in fact and by the commissioner shall be presumed to be correct. Isn't that? I mean, that was the old rule.
But the substantive standard in the rule for review by the reviewing judge didn't change a word. And the D.C. Circuit acknowledged that in Stone, made clear that its interpretation of the substantive standard applied to the new Rule 183 as well as Rule 182. And indeed, one of the frustrations we have in this case is the government changes positions, really re-argues settled questions about what that rule means. They try to persuade you that it's an open issue about whether Rule 183 requires a clearly erroneous standard or something else. That was settled by the D.C. Circuit in Stone. Now, if they're taking issue with Stone, we had no way of knowing that. We don't know what the legal standard that was applied by the reviewing judge was. In fact, they've now raised a question about how they understand Rule 183 and whether they mean to take issue with Stone. And we have no way of knowing what standard the reviewing judge applied. We have no way of knowing how he applied that legal standard. Your role under the review statute requires you to ensure that the tax court has acted consistently with law. That's the most obvious basis for reversing this bizarre process. I believe Article 3 of the Constitution requires what the statute says.
May I ask?
Yeah, of course.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you one more question about Stone. Was Stone addressing the new rule or the old rule?
Stone arose under the old rule. The court made clear that it knew the rule had changed. I believe it also made quite clear that because the substantive standard in the rule had not changed a word, its interpretation of that substantive standard applied both before and after. All the tax practitioners, by the way, believe have practiced under the clearly erroneous standard being the law. If you look at that Kafka article I already mentioned, he refers to Stone, as do all tax practitioners. It's only now in this litigation that we've learned, conceivably, possibly, the government has a different view about what Rule 183 means. But we never knew that before. You have no way of knowing what standard they applied under 183 or what meaning the tax court judge gave to 183.
But
and I just submit that cannot be a valid
rule. Is that a constitutional decision, Stone? On what basis did the D.C. Circuit make this?
Stone's decision was an interpretation of the rule, the substantive standard in the rule. We believe that interpretation is informed by due process considerations. That's why the administrative process is structured the way it is. In fact, our whole system gives deference to fact-finding that emerges from a valid process because that's how we find facts. And we need to know whether the process here was a valid process, the one specified legally by Rule 183, which says the fact-finder makes findings after a long trial, the reviewing judge reverses only clearly erroneous, and the Court of Appeals' role under Stone is to determine whether those initial findings of fact under the Rule 183 report are clearly erroneous. So your rule requires, if Stone is correct, your rule requires you to have that report to then determine whether its findings are clearly erroneous.
Is there always, at the conclusion of the hearing by the special trial judge, as you understand it, Mr. Billis, is there always a discussion between tax court judge and the hearing judge?
Your Honor, my understanding is that the reviewing judge is not assigned until after the Rule 183 report is filed. And in this case, the document, the order assigning the case of Judge Dawson, indicated that the report had been filed in September of 98. The case was assigned to Judge Dawson. Not until 1999 in December did his opinion come out, which is another indication of how much internal review of the facts, maybe modification of the facts, disagreement about the fact. We just don't know what happened in that process.
You ever heard of the universal camera?
Yes, Your Honor, I have. The dispute between Judge Hand and Justice Frankfurter. And in that case, because I do think it's relevant here, the dispute was about the relationship between the NLRB and one of its hearing examiners.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember that much.
Right. Okay, well,
the
dispute, Your Honor, was exactly relevant to our question here, because the issue was how much deference must the board give to the findings of fact of the hearing examiner.
Yes.
And there was no dispute that those findings were part of the record. And there was no dispute that the board had to give some level of deference to those findings of fact. The dispute was exactly how much deference to give.
I think the appellant was arguing that they had to give a lot more deference than the...
Judge Hand held that the board had to apply a clearly erroneous standard. I think Justice Frankfurter said that was too strong, but deference had to be given. But again, Rule 183 settles those issues in the tax court, because it says, as interpreted in Stone, the reviewing judge must treat those findings.
The problem is, it doesn't say that. It's Stone that put that gloss on it.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And if they have a different view about how the rule should be read, this has come up for the first time now, and we have no way to challenge it. And that can't be an appropriate process for a taxpayer charged with civil tax fraud.
What I find strange here is that this whole issue, not in the tax court apparently, but everywhere else in the jurisprudence has been, I mean, the universal camera case is 50 years old at least, I think.
Well, and Raddatz settled this issue with magistrates. And as you noted, Judge, the tax court operates in an extraordinarily loose fashion. And part of the function of the Article III courts is to ensure that the process is lawful and appropriate. That's exactly why we have Article III review and review under the statute of a body like the tax court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I wonder if given the additional time, if I can have literally checked
out. All right, Mr. Parks, you may.
There is a lot, I would say, and we say it in our brief, and I won't trespass on the court's time by repeating it, but let me just make one very simple point. The opinion and the August 30th order state the opinion that's before this court is the opinion of the special trial judge. We don't even have a question of what standard of review if it's the special trial judge's opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You won't let us see that report, though.
Don't think we have it out of here, Your Honor. It is delivered to process.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.